Game on 2FM.
With Gillette. Great performances begin with a comfortable close shave from Gillette. Gillette, making men's lives just that little bit easier.
Game on 2FM.
With Gillette. New SkinGuard Sensitive Razor. The first razor of its kind designed to stop irritation on sensitive skin. Gillette, the best a man can get.
It's 14 days to Christmas.
Yes, Monica. It's also Wednesday, the 11th of December. And coming up on Game On, Ali Pally awaits. We meet the Irishman heading to Dart's top table.
I think it's a great achievement for myself and it's good for me, the whole family and everything, because it's kind of what you dream of when you're young, dad. Like.
It's a big Champions League night, but closer to home, Limerick FC face extinction. We get all the facts.
Company behind Limerick FC now looks like it's going to have liquidated the pointers, and Limerick FC as it stands now is no longer in existence.
And Kevin Maxtay on why he calls management the pressure game.
Well, I think the worst pressure you can be is when you're facing into challenges that you know there's not going to be a result here. That, you know, the gap is just too big. And that doesn't often happen when you're a player.
All that and much more between now and 8 o'clock. Text us on 51552, WhatsApp on 087 187 9200 or tweet at GameOn2FM.
Game on 2FM.
Marie, how are we doing? Fantastic night last night at the HRI Awards. We got to hang around with Ruby for a bit.
We did. It was absolutely fantastic. Such a good night.
It was a good night. To be fair, they could smell the ga off you though and the rugby off me, couldn't they?
They were still really nice though.
They're incredibly nice people. Yeah. They really are.
And it's funny when you walk into a room like that, the amount of familiar faces, because we see so many of them on the TV, the O'Briens, Barry Geraghty, Ruby.
Yeah. And I started doing that thing, like I started acting like I knew them because I see them loads. You know that way? And they're like, ah, Aidan O'Brien, how are you doing?
Did you say anything else to any of the O'Briens?
I might have put my foot in it with the O'Briens. So I was there, lads, how are you getting on? It was Joseph and Aidan, and I was chatting to them. And they'd be heroes for me, but obviously put my foot in it. I was there about to head into the busy season and they were like, we're done with the flat stuff, Dunners. I was there, oh God, let the floor eat me. But do you know what I realised? Ruby is Lionel Messi and we slag him and we give him an awful time. But last night when he walked into that room, it was like the start of The Lion King. You know when Mufasa takes Simba up to Pride Rock and everyone starts genuflecting and just getting ready for him to come in. He is the man there, isn't he?
I think because we spend so much time with him in a very different scenario, like we're never on the racetrack with him, we're never around horse racing people with him. It's always in this studio chatting about loads of different sports that we kind of forget what he's accomplished in a way, and we just talk about football and GAA and rugby, and we kind of don't give him the credit he deserves, I think.
We don't give him any credit. And then you go into a room where he's just...
Actually, that's probably true. We don't give him any credit at all.
But do you know what I noticed? There's people, like I always noticed that, to be fair, about Paul O'Connell, you know when Paul O'Connell walks into a room. Like, honestly, you might have your back, but there's just a presence. And he's got that around, but he doesn't have it in this studio,
he
unfortunately. He walks in here and we're like...
Go make us a coffee, there, yeah.
We have to cop on. We can't be sending Lionel Messi to make coffees.
It's too far gone now.
Just keeping it.
Yeah, we're all the same in here.
One thing did knock him back a step in my book, though. Like, we were going to leave and...
We were mid-show, I think, nearly. We don't even think we were off air. And he was clearly in a hurry and he started to get changed while we were chatting live on air.
Actually, odd on that as well. We were there, who'd give me a lift? And you were ready before me.
That's true, yeah.
It's quite embarrassing. But what happened? Tell him what happened.
He took a hairbrush out of his handbag or his man bag and started brushing his hair.
Ruby Walsh has a hairbrush. Oh, I was bent over. I'm still not right over it.
No, I don't know how he's going to feel about us talking about it on air.
But he genuinely, and like it looks like an old hairbrush. You know,
he was very comfortable with that hairbrush, yeah.
It's not the hairbrush's first rodeo, like, you know. No, what I mean?
He didn't get a new hairbrush for the awards.
I could see him heading off, like, off to Cheltenham, right, I've got everything, the horses are on their way, I've got all my Jodhpurs and GLAs. Where's the hairbrush?
You won't thank us for this one, but I have to say credit to Horse Racing Ireland, they put on a great show. They honoured Ruby and Pat Smullen, gave them the Hero Award, and they did a lovely interview with both of their wives and their families. And it was just brilliant. It was so engaging getting to see all the little kids talking about their dad's achievements and the way horse racing has impacted their lives and what they get from it. And like to grow up and be still able to know what your dad's doing, like that's amazing. One of Ruby's little daughters was naming all the horses that he'd won on, and just from the pictures, and it was fantastic.
And do you remember I was saying, do you know a horse by, you know, its legs?
That's what you said.
That's what I said. But they remember for the award for Horse of the Year, I think it was. Was that what it was?
They showed
Tiger Roll's heir, and everyone went, "Oh, Tiger Roll." And I was there, they all know his ear. You know, they're just, but you're right there. And like Ruby, to be fair to him, he's done well for himself, but his family are incredible, aren't they? Just beautiful kids. And I was a bit envious. I'm not going to chat to Ruby anymore about horses. I'm going to chat to his kids because I think they can upskill me. And you know how they learned? Colouring them in. So they were there like, there's Ken Boy. And they're colouring him in.
So I'll get Ruby to bring in the crayons and the colouring book for you.
So I need a
away you go.
Paint by numbers for horse racing.
Yeah. It's a busy night of football tonight. Not too many big games, but plenty of games all the same. And it's the last night of the group stages. And I think from an Irish perspective, there is a lot of people going to be watching the Tottenham Hotspur game because there are suggestions that Troy Parrott might get on.
That'd be brilliant, wouldn't it?
I think it would. Yeah, like it's, we spoke so much about Mourinho and what he'd do when he came in with the younger players. And we've seen him, bring on Parrott only for 5 minutes, but still, at least he got his Premier League debut. We're going to actually hear a clip now from Jose Mourinho about staying focused.
We are going to focus more on us than on Bayern. We are going to try to develop our model of play. Of course, with different bodies, with different faces, with different players. But there is a certain way that we try to play football and to try to develop our principles of play, and we are totally focused on us and less on Bayern. One thing that I'm not having is time, and when I say time, I say also time to know my players well, and this is also a great opportunity for some of them to play, for some of them to show what they're capable of.
Okay, that was Jose speaking about tonight's big game, and we're delighted to be joined by Paul Carey, ex-Sheffield Wednesday. And Paul, how are you getting on?
Yeah, really good, guys. Really, really good.
Can I ask a question before we get into it? We saw a different side of Ruby Walsh tonight, last night. He had a hairbrush. Any of your teammates ever take out something odd that you're just going, what?
Careful
now. Okay, we're being careful. We're like, as if Bosco's listening. But like, something that you're just going, what the?
There would be a queue for the hairdryer after training.
A hairdryer?
Honestly, yeah. And this is football now. Football dress rooms. And the hair comes after the full body moisturising. Like, it's unbelievable. There'd be people there and you'd be thinking they'd be going off to get their nails done. It's that bad.
Yeah.
Now, I haven't gone quite to that extreme. Yeah. But I do own a hairbrush. I do.
Do you?
I'm the first person to admit it.
I don't.
What do you do? You have so much hair.
I just kind of like use my hands when I put in like Dax. I kind of give it a good old rub.
And my housemate plays with Sean McGroves and he uses my hairbrush.
No way.
Yeah.
Who is it?
Oh, I can't say.
I remember Rala though on one of the Lions tour. One of the Welsh lads asked, "Had he what are they called? The THG or what?
GHD.
There you go. One of those."
They're a hair straightener for anyone who doesn't know what a GHD is.
Is there
one in your house, Paul?
No, there's not. The worst thing now that I think about, I've seen, is tinted moisturiser.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I wouldn't know anything about that, but we are really interested if a few of your teammates have a few peculiar things for getting themselves groomed. 51552, or you can WhatsApp us on 087-187-9200.
Manchester City are trailing Dinamo Zagreb 1-0. Not that it really matters because they're already through.
No, I can't imagine they're going to be too concerned. That said, though, they did put out quite a strong team.
They're probably trying to bounce back after their tough week.
Yeah, he's probably trying to get maybe a bit of consistency and a bit of fluidity back into the team. And I read, one of the team members had said that they sort of lost their confidence. So I think when you lose your confidence, the best thing to do is try regain that as quickly as possible. So
I'd sure say it'd be hard to get your confidence back under Pep. I don't know why. I just...
Because he's so intense.
Yeah.
Mm, yeah. And I've heard a few people say that they look a bit jaded this season.
Mentally, like...
And then is that the reason to rest them up tonight? You know, could you give them... Like, I know you need confidence, but it's a dead rubber match, isn't it?
Yeah, it is a dead rubber, and they're through irrespective. So maybe he's experimenting a couple of things and a couple of personnel. But I would say if you gave him the option of winning or losing, he would most certainly take winning because there's such a big gap in the league in particular that they need to get right. But they haven't travelled well at any point since Pep's gone in the Champions League. So that would be something that would concern him.
Just your point on it there, Marie. Like, is he so intense that... It kind of comes to that point that it's nearly rubbing off on the lads, that they're nearly tired of it, you know, that...
Yeah, and he's not spent a huge amount of time outside of Barcelona with any one club, and there was this kind of debacle about whether he was going to stay on with Manchester City, but it does seem as if he's there for the long term. But yeah, maybe there is a case, you know, people are talking about Ireland rugby and the intensity of Joe Schmidt, so maybe when you have an intense character like that, maybe it is a certain sort of shelf life, the likes of a Jose Mourinho, where after 3-4 years players maybe start to get a bit jaded of it. But I think he's alluded to the fact that the likes of David Silva are coming to the end of his career, Fernandinho's coming into his end of the career, so they probably just need to freshen up maybe two or three faces. I don't think Pep's going to be going anywhere too soon.
They're probably looking at Liverpool as well, and Klopp, and the way that he treats his players and how personable he is as well. And
everyone just wants a hugger now, don't they?
That's what it is. Yeah, isn't it though, Paul? Like, it's man management is so different now. It's like the dictatorships don't seem to work, you know. It's one to one. You need to...
Well, Pep, the thing about Pep is Pep seems to have a really good relationship with his players, and you don't necessarily hear many players who have played under Pep say too many negative things about him. The other thing that could have drained Man City players is just the nature of Liverpool's results and the fact that they've scored a lot of late goals.
They're fed up, is that what you're saying?
Not fed up, but you know when you feel as if you're just getting a bit closer to them, or you're looking at a game you've played earlier on, or you're playing the next day and you're watching the Liverpool game and they've just been finding ways to win games, and through, you know, luck at times, of course you need luck, but that can drain the life out of you because you just feel as if you're never going to catch them.
Yeah, but I think they should have used, like, they had a bad spin on that, because it's easier to chase, isn't it? Yeah, like, they've never once put all the pressure on Liverpool, kind of saying, oh, they can't afford to slip up. I think Klopp has done a good job of just managing the media.
Yeah, they have, and I think Liverpool have probably played before Man City a lot of the time, and that's probably...
Yeah, there was a lot of the...
It's enabled to heap the pressure on, you know, the fact that you play on the Saturday and sometimes City play on the Sunday. But then I think City played ahead of them a couple of weeks ago and they actually got beaten and they dropped points, so... Yeah. You know, these things even themselves out at the end of a season.
Yeah, it's a long way to go yet, lads. They were good last night, topped their group and through Liverpool, I mean, through now to the next stage of the Champions League. But I thought Mo Salah was so interesting because it seemed like everything was going wrong for him, yet he was able to score a goal like that, the one that he did.
Yeah, the finish was absolutely outrageous. You know, it was such a tight angle, weaker side, defender running back towards the goal, and there was probably about 6 inches of a space that he could hit that he would actually score with, and he found the back of the net. So it's just trademark Liverpool, you know, you stay in a game for as long as you can, you just back those front three to go and score goals for you. And that proved to be the point. I would say that there was probably a bit of a nervy moment at half time when Napoli were winning. There was a chance for Salzburg down that end, and Haaland had that kind of a one-on-one with the keeper and he hit the side netting, and I'd say people were starting to get a bit nervous. But there seems to be such a belief amongst the squad that the players don't get nervous, that, you know, they just address situations as they happen. They back the team, they back the management, they back the players that they have, and they have confidence in themselves that they're going to go score goals. And why would you bet against that when you've got such a good defensive foundation in Van Dijk and Alisson in particular, and then you've got the likes of Arnold, Robertson, Keita, Salah, Firmino, Mane, somebody's going to score a goal.
But it doesn't seem like, you're speaking at that moment, they don't leave the pressure get to them. You know, like, they could be in the Europa League. It would be a disaster for Liverpool, wouldn't it, if, you know, it didn't go that way?
Yeah, it would. And I guess the important thing about that squad is that the majority of them now have reached two Champions League finals and they know how to get the job done. And there seems to be that aura of confidence. And actually, the confidence seems to have elevated itself to a new level this year because of how well they're going in the league. So they just seem as if they're going to get the job done. They know how they play the game. They're so dynamic going forward. But what they probably don't get credit for is actually when teams sit back, they seem to find ways of opening them up too, which Man City have sort of struggled with. But you know, if you're looking at the Champions League and you're talking about potential winners, when you look at Liverpool and you look at Barcelona at the moment, it's hard to look past those two.
Yeah. But isn't it great, Paul, that
no.
It's so exciting.
Stop. I'm a Chelsea
fan.
The
play is so exciting, though. Like, you know, even if you're not a Liverpool fan, like, it's kind of compelling to watch because it's unpredictable. You know, you're not, like, they're playing that type of football where it is edge of seat. Like, there are nervy moments. And then if you're a Liverpool fan and they get a late goal and they win, it's great. But at the same time, it is entertaining. And Klopp has always said that. He wants people to come back, like, to watch the game again. And he's doing that.
Yeah, yeah. I would 100% agree with you. And probably Man City play a different style of football in regards to that. It's so possession based. It's almost death by possession. And Liverpool are to the same extent, but Liverpool probably have a few more different ways of hurting you. And if you look at one of the goals last night, Jordan Henderson has just spun a ball in behind, and that's often the best ball. You know, you have to pick out the one that's going to hurt the opposition most, and that doesn't necessarily let you pass over 5-10 yards. They also have the willing runners in behind, and when teams go at pace and they're dynamic, it gets you off the edge of the seat, and they just seem to have that in abundance, whether it's through their fullbacks or whether it's through their midfielders or their front three. There's just so much strength.
That front three, everyone talks about it, and obviously, like, Salah could have had a hat-trick last night. Mm-hmm. He had plenty of opportunities, but you've been there. Like, that angle he scores off, is that virtually impossible, what he did?
It is, because of physics. You know, you're touching the ball around the keeper and all your momentum, all your body weight is going away from the goal. And it's just pure instinct. That's all you can put it down to, is pure instinct, that he knows where the goal is, because he hardly has a moment to lift his head, that he's literally just trying to execute as best he can.
Would a goal like that lift his confidence then? You know, if he said, you know, I should have scored more tonight, but then he looks back at that and he kind of goes, you know, shows I'm a different class.
I don't think that front three lack confidence, and that purely, if you take away the goals, purely the freedom that they play with when they step out in the pitch, it seems as if no opposition, no stadium phases them in any way, shape or form, and that has probably epitomised, the front three have epitomised everything that Liverpool have done in the last 12-24 months.
Jordan Henderson was captain's performance last night, and afterwards Van Dijk spoke about how he doesn't get enough credit outside the team, that inside the team, you know, inside their setup, that he's such a vital part of everything that they do. Why do you think he doesn't get enough credit?
Probably because he's not as pretty on the eye in regards to his playing style. So, you know, if you think about centre midfielders in the last 10-15 years who have been so successful, you're probably talking about the likes of a Gerrard, a Lampard, who are technically incredible, but that doesn't always constitute what a good player is. Like, sometimes, and why Henderson is so pivotal in that squad is because he's the one that drives everybody on. He's the one that seems to set the standard. You look in the first 5-10-15 minutes, he's winning tackles, he's driving people, he's trying to play forward, and passing isn't at the same level of a Busquets or a Rakitic or a Frankie de Jong, but what he does give you, he gives you heart, determination. And when you couple that sometimes with the Anfield crowd, somebody who's willing to drive you on can sometimes spur everybody else on. So he's almost that, if you're talking about, you know, culture and you're talking about the team and the glue, Jordan Henderson is probably the glue that keeps everybody together.
We're joined on the line by Fergal Brennan, a sports journalist, Merseyside. Fergal, would you agree that Jordan Henderson is the glue that keeps Liverpool together?
Yeah, I think that's quite a fair comment, really. When you think of his performances and the way that he plays, I think some of the points that were mentioned there before, and that he might not always catch the eye with a great pass or a goal or something like that in the way other midfielders do. But what he does offer is, and he's a real organiser on the field, and I think that's key for why Jurgen Klopp's such a big fan of him. And to call him the glue in the team, I don't think is far wrong. He offers a lot of leadership, a lot of organisation. He's able to implement the manager's plan. Obviously, it's a famous comment that's been made about many midfielders over the years, that's what they're able to do. They're able to be the manager's voice on the pitch, and I think that's what Henderson has been so far this season. And a lot of Liverpool fans are starting to change their opinion from being on the fence about him to being huge supporters of him now.
Fergal, it's his work rate though, isn't it? Like, off the ball, and that's what Liverpool are known for, but he's the driver of that.
He is, and particularly when you watch them live, and at Anfield you've got a very good seat from the press box, you see exactly how he measures, how much he has to run, and particularly the way that Liverpool play with fullbacks that are getting forward almost for the whole 90 minutes. He's constantly getting across to cover Robertson on one side or Alexander Arnold on the other. And that's, as you say, that comes down to the work rate and the determination of him, and that he puts himself in such a selfless position of, well, I might not be getting on the end of a cross into the box and scoring a winning goal, but I know that if a team breaks on us, I have to be covering at right back or covering at left back. And that's absolutely vital, not only just to the way Liverpool play, but to a team that's pushing for major honours, as Liverpool are. To have someone in the team that's willing to sacrifice themselves on such a regular basis is an enormous thing.
Fergal, we know that there's a hectic few weeks coming up now for Liverpool, but like, what are people expecting from them now in the next few weeks?
I think when you speak to supporters, they're very pragmatic about this. Obviously, they want them to go out and win every game and win every competition. But I think if you were to ask Liverpool supporters to be honest, and I do speak to them on a daily basis, they're quite clear that the league is the absolute priority. And then after that, it will be Champions League. Obviously, you mentioned the situation with the fixture pile-up and the Carabao Cup and the Club World Cup. Yes, that's on the list of priorities, the checklist for December. But in terms of priorities, it's the league and then the Champions League. The Carabao Cup, we're going to see an almost, not even under-23s team, maybe even an under-19s team sent out at Villa Park because of the crossover with the Club World Cup the day after. And I think that's the mentality going into what's going to be a really, really packed run of games between now and the end of 2019.
But Fergal, just looking at how he's rotating his squad, like, he left out Mane at the weekend and then he puts in such a performance, that will give the whole squad a lift, isn't it? That they know, I'm going to get a bit of time off, but when I come in, I have to give it my all.
And that's absolutely right. And that's absolutely crucial how Klopp manages the situation. There was a lot of surprise with some of the players that he left out for the Merseyside derby game. And then they ended up scoring 5 goals and comfortably beating their local rivals. Then, as you say, there was players left out for the Salzburg game last night. And someone like Mane, who didn't play at the weekend, then comes back in and scores and plays so well. And how Klopp manages that will probably decide how Liverpool end the season. If he's able to keep players motivated, as he has done with Mane, leaving him out for the Bournemouth win at the weekend to then bring him back in for Salzburg, demonstrates that he's got that balance right now. He's got that balance absolutely right of ensuring that his key players know just how important they are, but that there has to be rest worked into the schedule, particularly now at such a busy period.
Fergal, just on to Everton, we know that they're keeping their options open at the moment and there's lots of names being thrown around, from Carlo Ancelotti to Unai Emery. Have you any insight into who could possibly be taking the reins there?
One piece of information that I do have for definite, there was a press conference called earlier this afternoon. Duncan Ferguson will be in charge for the Manchester United game this weekend. The club have confirmed that, which indicates that they want to give themselves a few more days. Emery, as you mentioned, has kind of emerged as a bit of a bolt from the blue, as it were. I personally don't really see that happening. I think, given the fact that things ended so badly for him at Arsenal, I think we'll see a little bit of a period for him being out of a job as he looks to kind of gather himself and decide on his next project. I think I mentioned it on the show a couple of weeks back before the Merseyside derby about David Moyes, and I still think, for me, he's the primary target. I think what Everton have is a situation whereby they can have had a conversation with him and said, look, you're an option, albeit potentially a fail-safe option. As long as you're happy with that, which he appears to be, we're going to pursue other targets, keeping you in mind. It's a difficult one to kind of not make Moyes feel unwanted, but given the situation that they're in and the calibre of other managers being mentioned, I think it's the way they're looking to go forward. But in terms of the names that are being mentioned, he's still the one for me. Rafa Benitez and Vitor Pereira, who are both managing in China at the moment, have collectively ruled themselves out. So Moyes is still the front runner for a permanent basis, but there's a growing clamour within some supporters for Ferguson. I think if he gets a big result against United this weekend, we could potentially see those noises growing a little bit more.
Paul, would you think they would support him? Like Duncan Ferguson, it was brilliant to watch him, a guy that, you know, like, he nearly headered every ball, he kicked every, seen him on the touchline.
Hugged but every ball boy.
Yeah, he did, but it was nearly unfair on him in ways. You know, it's a big, big role.
It is, and obviously there's going to be a strong affiliation there with the fans at Everton. But is he going to be the man that's going to take that job to bring Everton forward? My instinct would tell me probably not. What he will probably bring is he'll get them back to basics and probably get them pressing and playing a game that Everton fans expect. And that's probably been missing in the last couple of weeks under Marcus Silva. So they probably need somebody to come in who's going to complement Duncan Ferguson as potentially a number two. But I think it requires somebody probably a bit more senior with a bit more experience to manage the level of investment they've had in that squad and to get them back to where they want to be.
There's a lot of managers out there as well, and some of the names that have been thrown around, they're big names, so it's, you can kind of see their point of view with the David Moyes as well, to give someone else a try. Fergal, just on, I'm saying Troy twice here, because yeah. I'm going to go on to Troy Parrott.
You've got him on the brain. Is he going to play?
Do you think we might see him tonight?
I think we'll see him at some stage. Mourinho was quite candid in his press conference before the Munich game tonight, saying that he's a big fan of him. Obviously, we saw the scenes at the end of the Burnley game at the weekend where he gave him the match ball after he got his Premier League debut. I would be very, very confident we'll see him at some stage in the Bayern Munich game tonight. Whether or not he'll start still remains to be seen. There's still probably about another half an hour before the team news gets announced. I would err on the side of caution that he's probably going to come off the bench. I'd love to see him start. I really, really would. But I just think, as much as this is a dead rubber and Tottenham are already through and Munich are already through, Mourinho is not in Mourinho's nature to take too many risks, even though he probably knows he has to give some of the young players at the club a chance if he wants to extend his time there. But I'd love to see Troy start. I think the likelihood is we'll probably see him come on in the second half.
Okay, Fergal, we will be keeping an eye on that and we will update all of our listeners if he does get that start. Fergal, thank you very much for joining us.
Brilliant, no problem, thank you.
Now, guys, we are going to stay with football because there was some news today about Limerick FC. We know that they are on the verge of extinction after the examinership process today. They were trying to keep their trading company afloat, but it ended unsuccessfully. And the club have not been granted a League of Ireland licence for next season, and court protection has been removed. Paul, that is not a good situation for Limerick. How big a blow is it?
It's probably the last thing we needed, given all that's been happening at the FAI and with domestic soccer. To see that one of the clubs who only a couple of years ago was playing in the Premier Division and looked like they were going to make strides in regards to the investment, the infrastructure, everything about the club and where they were trying to go. And for it to result in this is desperately sad. But if I was to stand here and tell you I'm surprised, I'd be lying, because I had friends down playing in Limerick and, you know, hearing about cash payments and brown paper bags and all sorts, the level of unprofessionalism down there seemed to be an extreme. And then you hear about Sean Russell and he's crying out to get an injury and an operation paid for during the season that the club wouldn't pay for. It smelt that something was wrong. And
of course, these are all stories that are being told. They're not anything that we are definitive about.
Yeah. So these are stories that have been passed from one person to another. But the League of Ireland doesn't need stories like this. And we need clubs in big cities. And Limerick is one of them. And it's not worked out for whatever reason. And it would make you think, have we got too many clubs as a whole within the League of Ireland system? Are we better off narrowing the focus and maybe looking at 12 to 14 clubs and just focusing on one division? Because something's not working between the Premier Division and the First Division, and I'm not sure anybody right now can put their finger on it. But from my point of view, I don't think we have the pool of players to support a two-tier division.
And we're very Dublin heavy, aren't we, when it comes to it?
Yeah, we are, and that's been the criticism, that because you have so many clubs in Dublin, well, then that spreads the support base across a number of teams and it lessens the attendances. And when Limerick were going well, and we've seen this down in Waterford as well, that when they have gone well, that the crowds have come in, but there's problems with sustaining that. Of course, fans are coming through the turnstiles when the results are good and when they look as if they're pushing on and getting to the next level. But there's no sort of sustainability about anything in the League of Ireland at the moment.
Now, it is a developing story. And earlier, our reporter, John Kenny, caught up with Don O'Sullivan of the Limerick Leader.
Yeah, it seems that way. September of 2019 is when the Examiner took over. A company put in place trying to see if anyone would be interested in investing in the club as it stood, as a current entity. And that came to an end today with the court removing the protection. And Munster Football Limited, which is the company behind Limerick FC, now looks like it's going to have liquidators appointed. And Limerick FC, as it stands now, is no longer in existence.
It's a huge debt, isn't it? Nearly half a million in terms of the context of League of Ireland clubs.
It's a massive debt in terms of any business, really, I suppose, that has the turnover, as you say, of a League of Ireland club. 490,000 is the figure given in court today. No one knows if that has grown since the examinership process started in September. So, unfortunately, there's a very stark figure when you look at it in black and white. And I assume when people investigated the books and looked to see if they were interested in investing in the current climate, they couldn't take over a League of Ireland club with that amount of debt.
Do you think this is the end of football in Limerick, or is there any move to perhaps bring something out of the ashes and get something going? Because 2020 looks like there won't be a senior club in Limerick.
Yeah, the first part of that question, do I think it's the end of senior soccer in Limerick? No, I think there's enough of an interest here, there's enough of a want here, for want of a better word, for senior soccer and League of Ireland soccer in particular. I mean, Limerick has shown that it can compete at the top level, albeit across different decades, unfortunately. But yeah, 2020 is not going to see senior soccer in Limerick, it looks like, now. Too short a window for anyone to come in and turn it around. There's one or two local clubs who also might fancy their chances at applying for a licence in time. They might see today's decision as an opportunity for them to fill that void. But there is enough interest in soccer, there's enough talent locally for some form of a Limerick FC club to come from the ashes, as you say.
When you look back at it, and not too recent distant past as well, they were playing in Thomond Park before they moved back to their traditional home in Markets Field. At that stage, things looked pretty good, didn't it?
Oh, phenomenal at the time. They signed a deal with the FAI for, I think it was 10 high-profile pre-season friendlies, one of which took place against Manchester City. And then, unfortunately, the others didn't materialise. As you say, back to the Markets Field, its ancestral home, huge crowds for playoff games. As you say, up to sixth in the Premier Division, playing a nice brand of football too on a good surface at the time in front of large partisan support. I mean, there was a good atmosphere there. There was a good vibe there. But as every week passed, more and more, I suppose, chinks in the armour became visible to people from the outside looking in. And, you know, a lot of goodwill was lost locally with fans and with businesses. It just wasn't, I suppose, running the right way, and unfortunately just slipped through the hands now and has gone out of existence. Even ending last season, you know, Tommy Barrett did a great job with the squad he had, and then deducted points post the finish of the season. It's just, everyone just grew so frustrated, and I think today was more of an inevitable end as opposed to a shock to anyone in Limerick.
You talk about one or two clubs maybe interested in filling that void. Who are they?
Well, the one that I think is positioning itself brilliantly on local level is Ashley Anacotti. I mean, they've kind of muted that they'd be interested in even taking on an underage licence, the under-15 National League at the time. There was rumours they were interested in that. They recently held a very successful match against Liverpool Legends, which had all the feel of maybe showing off that their grounds could hold large crowds and that they could run a big event.
That was Donna Sullivan there speaking to John Kenny earlier. Now, the FAI did release a statement in response to today's news. They said they were disappointed with the end of the examinership at the parent company of Limerick FC. They said there's been no contact between the Limerick owner, Pat O'Sullivan, and the FAI over how he intends to proceed following today's news. No application for a League of Ireland licence was made by Limerick FC as the club was in examinership. So I don't think we're going to get too many conclusions today from that. But what we do know is that it is a very grim situation in Limerick. And just from a player's point of view, we're going to hear from Stephen McGuinness from the PFAI very shortly. But like, Paul, I'm sure you know so many of the footballers who were caught up with Limerick. Like, how difficult is it to lose a club?
Yeah, it's really difficult. And I think when particularly people from Dublin and people that I would have known who have travelled down to Limerick really embed themselves in the environment and the city, and they've have nothing but fond experiences, and that stems from the club to the city to the fans. Loved it, absolutely loved it. So to lose not only any club but to lose Limerick in particular is desperate, and it's just a really sad state of affairs, because it makes you wonder, particularly if I was a player, how many other clubs are potentially nearing that situation, or if a main investor pulls out, does it mean that my contract's in jeopardy? And it's just not the type of stories we need, particularly with domestic football here.
You mentioned some of the players saying that they absolutely loved it. And I saw Brendan Clark, who was the goalkeeper down there for quite a while, tweeting about how much he enjoyed his experience there and how disappointed he was that that they couldn't do something to save it, and it's just a sad day for Limerick, and he feels for the supporters, and that's it. There are so many good football people down there. Now, I mentioned that we spoke to Stephen McGuinness a little bit earlier, and before we get to him, it's 1-1 in the City game. Gabriel Jesus has equalised, but let's hear from Stephen McGuinness. He gave his reaction to today's news.
I suppose it's not a huge surprise. I mean, anybody who would be looking closely at the league would have seen over the last number of years that we have balloted for strike action at the club in the last two seasons due to unpaid wages. We had an issue this year where one of our members, an amateur player at the club, had required an operation, and the club hadn't got the insurance in place for the player to have the operation done. So there has been huge financial issues for quite a while at the club. So as much as nobody wants to see any club go, and particularly in Limerick, where from a junior football point of view, it's a hotbed. It's hugely disappointing that they haven't got a license, that they won't be in the league next year. But I think anybody being realistic, you could see this coming.
Stephen, obviously this is a really terrible situation, but is this in relation to everything that's gone on with the FAI, or is it just a poorly run club?
Come the end of it definitely looks from our perspective like it was a poorly run football club. The issues that I have seen in the last 2 years, where we have had the ballot for strike twice, we tell you that there was issues there, financial issues that have been ongoing. And the owner of the club has put a huge amount of time and effort into the club and maybe just wasn't able to do it forever. And unfortunately, that didn't seem to be anybody else willing to come in and take on the debts that are there currently. And it's, as I said, it's hugely disappointing. I'm in Manchester today where we played Rochdale with 15 out of contract professional players looking for employment. And clubs going like Limerick, who offer potential employment for our members, it's something obviously that we wouldn't welcome. And it's hugely disappointing. When you run a football club, you've got to run it within the parameters of the licensing system, and you have to make sure that you're able to pay your bills every week, and you shouldn't be stressing yourself beyond that. And unfortunately, in Limerick's situation, as I said already, I think they've seen it coming. When you look at the rest of the league last year, there was no real financial issues in the league in regards to a wage perspective. Things have got a little bit better in regards to the stability of our clubs and the stability of the salaries. So Limerick was an isolated incident last year. It's not to say that in the future it can't happen, but this should be a warning to all clubs that if you don't do your business right, that there is potential that football will be lost in the area or in the county. So you have to run it properly. And obviously the FAI has felt from a club licence perspective that there's too many issues and we couldn't continue. And that's hugely disappointing. But it again shows that the clubs, if you don't do your business right, these are the effects that can happen, and you don't get a licence. And football not being in Limerick is a huge blow to the league.
And Stephen, what about the players that are owed money? Will they get it?
Yeah, no, there's one player only that's owed, and obviously there's a liquidation process that's going to take place. It looks like it's going to take place, and we just have to see what happens from that. Obviously, you represent the player to the end, and we just have to see what comes out of the liquidation.
You mentioned amateur players there that need operations, or just what happened to those guys?
Yeah, well, ourselves, Dunica, and a couple of other parties got together to fund that operation. So we pay that cost. So from that perspective, that individual player has had his operation done and is having his rehab, and that's been funded by ourselves and a number of other parties. So that has as such got the club off the hook. But again, I was hugely disappointed that the club didn't look after the player.
Stephen, is it realistic to think that there will be a football club in operation in the league in Limerick next season?
At this stage, probably, I'd say it's highly unlikely. It's too short a period of time. By the time somebody would get another application in for licensing, sign players, get a manager, get a ground, I think it's highly... There's talk of Shamrock Rovers having a B team, which obviously would take Limerick's place. So I think that's more realistic.
That was Stephen McGuinness there of the PFAI speaking to us earlier. We've had some texts in. How many Cork and Limerick teams have gone to the wall in the history of the LOI by comparison to the rest of the country? Soccer is clearly the fourth sport in the region and always will be. Ask Dunica what type of crowds local AIL games get from Gareth in Armagh.
Yeah, it can depend. Like Young Munster's Gary Owen, that's back to the good old days. But you're right, it was down in Ballinahinch and Corcon, and it's low when it comes to numbers like that.
Paul, Stephen mentioned Shamrock Rovers entering a B team there. Is that something that you'd be in favour of?
Purely on the basis of resources, yes, because you'd know that they'd be able to sustain it, and they would able to maybe add something to the league, and it then creates a pathway for some of the players who were in that academy, and their academy is by far and away the best out there. So in from that side of things, yes, you would probably back it, knowing that they'll do it right.
Paul, sorry, we got away from the Champions League. Marie, obviously a massive Liverpool fan, hogged all the time, but Chelsea had a great result over Lille, 2-1. It was nervy though in the end, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was, and there was those kind of last 5-10 minutes when if Lille got a goal, they were going out of the Champions League. So a really, really important win for Frank Lampard, and enough to get them through to the next stage. but he will want to see probably improvements in performances. They were okay again last night, and it's kind of been okay since the international break. So there's room for improvement there, but getting through to the next round for him and for his confidence as a manager was really, really important.
And from where they came from, starting the Valencia game, losing that and turning it around.
Yeah, it's been a kind of topsy-turvy campaign. That group has been strange, because I'd say there's a number of people who would have looked at Ajax last night and expected them to go through, and Valencia have nipped a result. So every team between Valencia, Chelsea and Ajax seem to be taking points off one another, but for them to get out of the group and to get into the last 16, particularly with blooding some of their younger players and what they're trying to create for future years, it's going to be invaluable experiences.
Paul, thanks so much for coming in. We leave you, get home, get your hairbrush back to your teammate and those skinny jeans, I imagine. All right, thanks so much. We're going for a break.
Game on 2FM.
With Gillette Skin Guard Sensitive. The first razor of its kind designed to stop skin irritation. Revolutionary technology, taking the pressure off the blades and your shave. Gillette, the best a man can get.
Now to GAA here on Game On, and journalist Damien Lawler joins us on the line, as he does every Wednesday. Damien, how are you?
I'm good, Marie. I'm good. How are you?
I'm great. I'm actually delighted that you're there, because my buttons are all over the place and I was trying to figure out which one to press, and I found your first go, so I'm winning.
Yeah, I'm here, live and clear.
Brilliant. So, a bit of news from Offaly last night. Michael Deignan is the new chairman of Offaly GAA. A positive move, do you think, Damien?
I think so. I think he was part of a representative group, Marie, the likes of Brian Whelihan, Stephen Darby, Brian Gavin, himself. They met with Tommy Byrne, the former chairman, now we call him. And I suppose they were upfront about it. They said that they felt it was time for a change at the helm of Offaly GAA. Tommy didn't agree with that. It went to a vote last night, and Michael Deignan came out on top, 76 votes to 62. So it wasn't a resounding win or anything like it, but it was enough to get him into the hot seat. And I think it's a long-term project. I think he'll be there for, obviously, the five-year term, if he can keep the position between then and now. But I think every one of those 5 years will be needed, Marie. There's an awful lot of work to be done down there. But yeah, I think Michael is fairly clued in. He's clued into the modern ways. He probably sees the cultures in other counties. And I'd say he knows that things need to change in his own county. So he did an interview last night just saying that he's in this for the long term. So be very interesting to see how it goes.
How important is it to have a man like that that's been there, knows the kind of what's needed on and off the pitch?
I think it's important. I think, you know, it's been a fall from grace for Offaly GAA in many ways, Donica, both in terms of hurling prowess and football prowess. They've dropped down to the Christy Ring Cup in hurling, which seems shocking, but really isn't shocking, because they've been falling gradually every single year for the last nearly 15, 20 years, to be honest about it. Their footballers, they're gone down the league divisions as well, Donica. So in terms of their finances, O'Connor Park is a lovely stadium, but there's always a bit of friction there, whether a hurling game should be played there or Burr, where the hurling strongholds is. I would feel that there's an apathy among a lot of players in Offaly towards hurling and football that don't necessarily want to commit to inter-county squads. At underage, they've been torn apart. Even in hurling, being beaten by the likes of Carlo over the years, which they wouldn't have countenanced maybe two decades ago. So I think an awful lot needed to change. There were signs that they were slowly starting to get their act together. But I think a new broom will help sweeping changes come in. And a person of Deignan's stature, it's not going to be a bad thing to have him there at all. He's very enthusiastic as well. Gets on well with people. And I would feel, though, that they're going to have to change the culture. They're going to have to bring in a business model. They're going to have a strategic plan, and they need to go on to get the clubs on side. And just guys from talking to the clubs down there, they're not happy with the fixture programme, like so many counties, and they're not happy with underage games as well. So he has an awful lot of work to do. I would imagine he'll set up about four or five subcommittees, find out what needs to be solved and get them working on it straight away.
Just given Offaly and their tradition and the pride that's in the county, is he going to get the time? Like, are people going to have patience, or is there going to be a massive expectation on Offaly to return to somewhere even near a glory day in the next few years, Damien?
I think you get time, Marie. I think they know that they've nearly reached rock bottom. I think they're completely disillusioned with it. Just from covering games down there, crowds have fallen off completely in terms of both hurling and football. So I think that it's pretty much gone as low as it can. And I do feel that people like Mary Dunn, the PRO, and maybe Brian, the vice chairman, they stepped away. They're good people. I think Dignan's going to do all he can to get them back into the fold. Because I think that it's only a small band of committed people in that county who are willing to put their shoulder to the wheel. I think Michael will need every single one of them with him. Will he get the time to deliver? I think he will. Once you can see that progress has been mapped out and that there's targets being hit, I think commercially they're going to need to get money in. Developing squads, they're going to need to look at that, and they're going to have to bring hurling back to the schools in Offaly, because that was the foundation and the cornerstone of every bit of success Offaly hurling had. And with the exception of Colosh de Cullen from Tullamore, you know, and maybe Eden Derry in the football, their schools have been way off. So there are two or three things that need to be done straight away. They won't be turned around overnight, Marie. So they're going to need 3 to 5 year plan to get anywhere up the ladder is what I'd be thinking. Now, they should get out of Christy Ring, but that going to the Joe McDonagh Cup won't represent progress there. They're going to need a lot of time to get out of there and get back up to the Lee McCarthy, for instance.
Damien, just moving on to Galway now, we saw that the GAA there is under more pressure with the release of a statement from their official supporters club questioning their links with the county board. What's going on down there now?
Yeah, so a bit like the challenge that Dignan and Tommy Byrne had in Offaly last night, the convention is coming up there very, very soon, Marie. Pat Carney, the Galway chairman, he's going to be taken on by Mick Culhane. Now, Mick Culhane is a devout fundraiser for Galway GAA, a prolific fundraiser, a good businessman, and he's very close to the scene as well. So he thinks, obviously, that there's time for change needed as well. I think he had the comment that it's time to get more into the 21st century with the way they do things. Just the background there, over the last few years, there's been scrutiny on the amounts of money registered on a Galway GAA credit card. Pat McDonagh very recently came out and looked to know where his sponsorship money was going to. And this year, Marie, they've made a loss of 261,000. Their income has dropped by €1 million. The expenditure, in fairness to the Galway County Board, has dropped too, but there's been a 20% drop in income. And that has prompted the Tribesmen GAA Supporters Club to assess their future. And a recent Mazars report put Galway GAA finances down as being a medium risk. The Supporters Club have raised £1.2 million over 3 years. They're not happy with the direction that things are going in. So a bit like what you've had in Mayo, they're weighing things up. And I see where Supporters Club describe Galway GAA as a €4 million business and said it needs to be run more efficiently like a business. So that's probably what's going on there. While people in Mayo are having a public battle over Twitter, it seems, it's not too private in Galway either. It's starting to come to a head there too.
Well, when you're talking about GAA county boards and mentioning Mazars in the same sentence, we're never in a good place. Just moving on then, Damien. No. The Talent Academy and Player Development Review Committee found many good practices in place, but also a number of challenges to the development of our players, especially our young players. What were their key findings?
Well, can you remember this time last week, Marie, I got an awful lot of friction for saying that under 17 should be a developmental competition.
And yes.
The two lads there beside you didn't agree with me. And look, a lot of people didn't agree with me, to be honest with you. But the GAA Talent Academy and Player Development, they had their report findings, as you say, released yesterday. And basically, that was one of the recommendations. So what they're saying is elitism has come into the association. We're taking the benchmarks of professional sporting organisations and using them in the GAA. What they're trying to do now is maybe get away from the fact that if you play for your county under 14, that you're automatically driven to win an All-Ireland. They say that between the ages of 13 and 15, it's very inappropriate for that to be the case. They reckon that their cultures and their DNA are being threatened, and they recommend a new player pathway, taking away focus from academies and development squads and putting them back into the clubs, Marie. They're also recommending better education for players and coaches, better governance, and an altered games programme. So they interviewed 1,000 people. They took on board 7,000 pieces of data. And now they want under 17 to be developmental. They want the under 17 All-Ireland to be tiered. They want the same for under 19 and 20. That means you have an All-Ireland A, B and C. I think they want to adopt the Celtic Challenge model, which has worked so successfully and has been a huge boost to the GAA. So At schools level, they're looking at that too, and they say they only want an All-Ireland at senior level. And then we've had many conversations about Sigerson and Fitzgibbon Cups. When do you play them? Are they in danger of being extinct? This workshop review committee, they want those competitions played between October and January. And he highlighted Brian Cuthbert, the former Cork manager, Dr. Brian Cuthbert in Umry. He highlighted a text message yesterday where a competition for Fela, which is under 14, as we know, is one of the great institutions of the GEA. It was due to start in spring. Players got a text requiring them to be training from November onwards. Stuff like bring a foam roller. Only 25 players will make the squad. If you don't make the squad, you'll be on the B team. If you don't make the B team squad, you'll be on the C team. Brian Cuthbert and these people, Mick Dempsey, Shane Flanagan, they've had enough of all that way of thinking. And that's what came out yesterday.
Yeah, Damien, thanks as always for joining us. We're tight on time, but we didn't even get to ask you what colour you like your slitters. We might take it up on that next week. We're heading for a break. 2FM.
Game on 2FM.
With Gillette, new SkinGuard Sensitive Razor. The first razor of its kind designed to stop irritation on sensitive skin. Gillette, the best a man can get.
Now we have some news on Game On, and before we get to it, I'd like to introduce our contributor tonight, Michael Glennon, who is also an Offaly man and a Spurs man. What is the news, Michael?
The news is, I guess, that Troy Parrott's on the bench for Spurs, but that was...
I thought you'd be more excited about it.
I mean, it is great. I mean, once he wasn't in the youth squad earlier on, I guess he was always going to be in this squad.
Mick, I'm sorry. She set you up there for that to be the biggest news of all time. Yeah, yeah. The way you introduced him there, you swear he had the lottery numbers.
Yeah.
It's a big deal. Like, it must be a big deal for you as a Spurs fan to have a young lad on the bench from Dublin, only down the road there.
Yeah, I know, absolutely. You know, it's very exciting.
Probably get on.
And I suppose the worry was when Mourinho came in, he was obviously Pochettino favourite. Parrott had given him a run in the Carabao Cup, and maybe the panic was that Mourinho would just stick to the more established players. But now this is a good opportunity for them with both the teams through to maybe give them 5 minutes at the end tonight.
Five minutes.
Hold on. He's only 17.
I love that.
Okay, from that anticlimax to which would hopefully be a good item, I would introduce it, but I'm going to let this do it.
I love it.
So the World Darts Championships are going to get underway at the Ali Pali on December 13th. And to preview all of the action, we are joined by Michael Glennon, as I said earlier, who's an RTÉ sports journalist. He's a Spurs fan, he's an Offaly fan, and he's also a darts fan.
Correct.
So this competition has the biggest number of Irish players ever. Tell us about them.
Correct, yeah. Last year they had six, and that was the biggest at that stage. And this year, it's an expanded tournament as it was last year, but they've got eight guys in, which is the biggest ever from the island of Ireland.
Who should we be looking out for?
Okay, so it's funny. Keane Barry is a guy who was in RTÉ yesterday. We did an extended interview with him. He's 17. When he plays on Monday night, he'll be the youngest ever Irish player to play at it. He won the Irish match play. That's how he got into the World Championships. The day before that on Sunday, there's a young man from Cork playing, Kieran T, and he's only 20 as well, and he was kind of a off the radar guy who came in after playing well on the development tour. The bigger name then will be Daryl Gurney, who's world number 6, has won a couple of majors in his time, and Brendan Dolan as well. This will be his 12th time playing at the World Championships, so they're 4 of the 8 guys.
Marie, can we tell the story about what we passed yesterday? Yeah, when Keane Barry was in.
Oh, yes, you tell the story.
Yeah, we were passing you yesterday. You were inside and he was throwing a few darts.
Yes, I remember.
You're a very trusting man because you were holding the dartboard, like.
Correct, yeah. We were doing a little bit for RTÉ Online, so it'll be an extended interview with Keane, and he was doing some shots, and I wanted to hold up. I'd no standalone board, so I had to hold up the board. And I was trusting because I guess if a guy who was qualified for Alexandra Palace you know, hits the side of the board, then Dennis Notch, he's got there because he's well able to hit the bullseye or the treble 20. Although he did, there was a bounce out and it did hit me, but I kind
no
of
way.
Encouraged it. There was, yeah, because he'd got two bulls and he said, will I go for the third? And I said, go on, sure, what's the worst that could happen? He goes, I don't want to hit you. Smack, lose an bang, eye. And it came in.
It's like William Tell.
Almost. No, I was.
Well, you did interview him yesterday and we have a clip of that interview, so let's hear from him.
After the game, it's kind of hard to take everything in. You're straight away after the game, you're going up and it's actually happening. Like, am I actually going to be playing there? But when the draw happened, then you're thinking, geez, this actually is happening. So it's just about getting the right preparation and get everything kind of ready in line for the game. Like, and it's I think it's a great achievement for myself and it's good for me, the whole family and everything, because it's kind of what you dream of when you're a young lad. Like, but I never really thought I'd be 17 and playing in the World Championship, but I'm delighted to be there.
You've been drawing a bit of attention to yourself since that as well. You've picked up a couple of titles. You've thrown a 9-darter on the development tours. Tell me about how the last couple of months have been.
Yeah, like it's been really. I didn't really get a break even after that. I was away. I was playing in World Masters. I won the World Youth Masters. I qualified for the BDO Youth Final. And I played in the development tour as well, hit a 9-darter. And it's kind of been really busy. Like, they haven't really had much time to even kind of set myself down and think about the last maybe two weeks. I had a bit of a break, and it was good to get the break as well to kind of get the right practice in and right preparation. But I said to myself, it's not the best draw, but it's not the worst draw either. Like, because Vincent's a fast player. And he's just going to get on with the game, same as me. There's going to be just two lads up there throwing darts, and there's not going to be no slowing down or anything, just a normal game. Like, and I wasn't really thinking too much about who was playing, but I went over to my nanny's to watch it, and just sitting there, and everyone was watching it, and I told my nanny I was playing Dave Chisholm if I won, and the first thing she said was, oh, no. So I was like, that's great. You have great faith in me anyway, but it's good. It was a good draw, and it's a fast-paced game, so we suit me down to the ground.
Keith sounds like an incredible fellow, but I get that as well. Why does darts always remind me of Christmas and my nan?
Oh yeah, well that is very common. I suppose that the attention that it gets around Christmas, Sky Sports put on, it's the whole nine yards. They put on a Sky Sports darts channel now. It's obviously the biggest event of the year is the World Championships, and it happens around Christmas. So it's a lot down to do with the job that Sky Sports have done to make it such a television spectacle, and the crowd love it. You can see, actually, there's always great atmospheres. I've never heard of any major trouble. I think maybe you have one or two stories from your time visiting Ali Pali, but you never hear of any. There's always great banter between the crowds. Yeah. They're chanting at each other. And it's a real sit-down sport. So if you're around with your family, there's incredible drama contained in these games, where if you have one guy with three darts and he has to hit a double and it seems simple, and all of a sudden the first one goes wide, the second one goes inside, and then he's up to another double and he misses, and the pendulum swings immediately to the other guy who has three darts and surely he'll hit it. And it just is incredible drama in the sport.
Man City are 3-1 up. Gabriel Jesus has completed his hat-trick. And Donica, if you think that we're going to let you off the hook here, Mick Lennon mentioned there that you have been to the Ali Pali. Tell us
and security,
what happened.
I've been to the Ali Pali. We went with Worcester for one of our Christmas parties. So I was dressed up like one of the Jamaican bobsleigh team. So, which isn't a great outfit because I had a zip on my back and you can't go to the toilet all that much. But you have to ask your teammates to unzip you. But I was in the Ali Pali. You're right. The greatest atmosphere you've ever been a part of, like 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And you'd swear it was like Vegas. It was just crazy. But I was trying to separate a fight between two of my teammates. They were just fighting among themselves. One dressed as Popeye, one dressed as the Flash, and Jenny had just sent me a WhatsApp, and my little girl Sophie, who was singing in the nativity, like she was singing Oh Holy Night, and here I am like a Jamaican bobsleigher holding the Flash and Popeye away from each other. So,
and happy out, I'd imagine. So Michael, who are the favourites for this World Championship?
Well, the usual suspects, really. So Michael van Gerwen is the 3-time world champion and defending champion. He has actually never defended his world crown, so he's trying to make it 2 in a row. It's hard to look past him. There's a couple of other guys in the mix. I mean, the guy who has come in over the last year is Gerwin Price, and he's a former rugby pro.
So there's hope for Donegal if he takes up darts.
Actually, very well.
No, there's not. No, I haven't hit a barn door.
Yeah, no, he used to play. He played for a short period with Glasgow, and didn't get a didn't extend that contract, but then he started to get good at darts. He took it up. We had him on the rugby podcast actually here during the year as well. And he's, do you know Butch Harmon, the golf commentator, one of his phrases is about, you know, a drive goes down the fairway, he goes, he couldn't have placed it any better. What I'm noticing about Gerwyn Price at the moment, his first dart is landing beautifully in the top corner or waist, leaving lots of room for the other darts to follow it. He's on form. He's won a couple of titles this year. He's beaten Van Gerwen in a semi-final a couple of months ago. And he's just really coming into form at the right time. He's actually a great personality in darts now. He kind of rubbed a lot of people up the wrong way. He gets the pantomime boos all the time from the crowd because he seems to give it large, even if it's not a winning shot, if it's just a good setup shot. And I kind of fancy them two to meet in the final.
Yeah, it's fascinating. I always get a kick out of it. I think darts is one of those games, though, that everyone can play. And what's the reason we're getting so many Irish through at the moment?
Okay, well, I actually was talking to Keane Barry about this. There's 8 Irish, as we said. One of the reasons is that the standards across the board has risen. So after Phil Taylor retired, he just rose up the standards. Mm. There's massive prize money up for grabs now. If you wanted to be in contention to win some of that money, you had to raise your game. So if you were practicing 2 or 3 hours, you had to make that 4 or 5 hours. And all of a sudden, after Phil retired and Michael came through, it was a bit more open. So these were realistic goals for guys, but they had to raise the standards. So there's a good example of, say, when Eric Bristow won his first world championship in 1980, his three dart average was 88. Keane Barry won a tournament a couple of months ago with an average of 100. So everyone has had to get better. And in Ireland as well, there's a few guys on the development tour. The Professional Darts Corporation have a development tour where younger guys who are not fully on the pro tour can go and be meeting guys of a similar standard throughout the year. And it's all raising up through that.
There's two female players as well taking part, Fallon Sherrock and Mikuri Suzuki. How are they expected to get on?
Last year, there was this first year that they had two female competitors, and they actually played very well. Lisa Ashton and Anastasia did very well, no disgrace whatsoever. They didn't win their games. I know Fallon Sherrock, when she qualified, after 4 legs of her final match, she was averaging 107. Now, that's an average that will win most games on the PDC circuit. I would say, you know, there's no doubt if they play well, it's over an extended period and they're going to play guys with a lot more experience on that stage. But looking at these people, Suzuki is the reigning BDO ladies champion. So, and she's brilliant to watch, and you can't tell any difference really, except when it goes on for an extended period and maybe they fade off a bit. But it wouldn't be, I don't think anybody would be too surprised if either of them won the game.
I think they need to tap into nanas. We used to play 501 every Christmas with my nan, and she was deadly. Honestly, we used to pay £1 on it, and she would hammer the whole lot of us. You're not having that, Marie.
No, like, I never played darts ever as a kid.
Who do you think would win the game of darts? Me, Marie, or Ruby? Have you still
right.
got that
well,
dartboard?
I think we can get the dartboard, but actually I would say Ruby would win that because I just don't think he'd take losing that well.
And he kind of wins everything, so...
Yeah. And even if would he change the rules if he lost?
Probably.
No, we need to play that. We
can play that. Thanks. We will play that. Raymond van Barneveld, can he bow out in a high?
No, is the short answer. It'd be great to see it. He's legend of the game. He has brought so much to the sport, but he's really struggled over the last couple of years to make an impact. And it's unlikely for him to get a long run on it, but the crowd love him, and it'd be just great to see him if he even won a couple of matches.
Yeah, he's always judged himself on what Phil Taylor achieved, and he always wanted to be judged on that, so it's probably a bit late for him now, isn't it?
It is. What happened was, Raymond was a 4-time BDO champion, and he was the star of the show over there. But when the PDC kept getting bigger and bigger, he transferred over. And the first year he moved over, he met Phil in the final, and they won a classic game in 2007. It was probably one of the best game of darts ever played. And I even heard an interview with him during the week. He said if he had known then that would be his last time to win a world championship, you know, he wouldn't have believed it, but it was. And his form over the last couple of years has just not been great. He's 52, and he's struggling to go on the tours and, you know, be consistent when he gets up on the stage.
So we talk about the characters in the game and how important they are. Who are you most looking forward to seeing?
Well, actually, just because we've done a good bit with him, I'm really looking forward to seeing Keane Barry. And it's a good one. He's playing on Monday night, and it's going to be, there's four matches on every night for the first first couple of rounds. And this is going to be almost the full Irish, we believe. So there's three guys. Steve Lennon is playing Callan Ritz. Willie O'Connor is playing Cantelli from Finland. Keane Barry is playing Vincent Vandervoort, as we spoke about. And if Brendan Dolan wins his match on Sunday, he'll play Gary Anderson on that night. So it's just going to be a massive Irish.
We met him with you the other day. He's a lovely young fella, isn't he?
A lovely young lad, very grounded, and he knows his time on his side, so he will, there's a Q school at the end of if he goes deep in this tournament, for example, he could automatically get a card, but there's Q school next January, and he's philosophical about that. If he qualifies and goes on the pro tour now, it's fine, and he's not too worried if it doesn't come for another couple of years.
Michael Glennon, RT sports journalist, thank you so much for coming in to us. No doubt the darts will keep us entertained on many a cold night over Christmas, and for the night that's in it, let's play it out.
Yeah, hey.
Club Rossi, the supporters club of Roscommon J Club, have been in the news over the last couple of days because they are auctioning off a house in London. So as we've seen over the last little while, many JA clubs and county boards have been auctioning houses around the country to try and raise money for the ever-growing expenses and the money that it takes to raise, the money that it takes to keep the show on the road in county boards. And one man that knows an awful lot about that is the former Roscommon manager, Kevin Maxtay.
When you're facing into challenges that you know there's not going to be a result here, that, you know, the gap is just too big. And that doesn't often happen when you're a player. You're in the right tier, you're in the right league, and you're all, as a player, always believing you're competitive. But when you're a manager and you're looking, you know, say you qualify for Super 8 and it's a tough group, and you're looking around, and I know everybody says, there has to be belief, and you have to always believe you'll win each game. And you do to a certain extent. But that absolute rock-solid belief and confidence when you're playing a Dublin or you're playing a Kerry or whatever, and you know they're going well and you know there are aspects of your game that are serious deficits, I think that's a huge pressure. Trying to get your group to get out there and give their all, to go out there and believe they have a chance, when, you know, the numbers, the stats, everybody's writing you off, you know, and they can't all be wrong. And I think that's a very tough reality, and from reality comes that pressure that there's a big crowd following your team, they're going up to a big match, they're always hoping for the best, you know, and here you are in the build up to it, saying, you know, this ball has to bounce so kindly for us to get any sort of a competitive run in it. And that's, I found that the hardest part, you know, when you're going to play Dublin in Croke Park in a National League match or a Championship match, and you just, it's, I won't say damage limitation, but you know this result is only going one way.
But Kevin, you're the rock then for the players, aren't you? Because I just know for myself personally, I might have self-doubt, but I need to look up at the coach, the manager, and know he fully believes, and I'll follow him.
And Dominic, do you ever wonder, like, the manager is human too. He has his own doubts and issues, and of course the management team, and we're all trying to convince ourselves that we're going in the right direction, we're doing this right, our training is good, our setup is good, our players are good, but there is still a reality there, you know. I know sport sometimes can make a mockery of that reality, and we did a few times during the 3 years. But in an overall sense, I'd have to say that the expectation levels, once you become a Division 1 team or a top 8 team in the Championship, the pressure levels are ramped up, because there is expectation. Even we were ranked maybe 6, 7, 8, 9, something that would be our ranking throughout the 3 years, and that was great for us, Roscommon. Like, we were upwardly mobile, we were moving in the right direction. But the gap between one and five, from one to four, and then the next group, and then the next group, the gaps are really, really serious. Like, it's, I won't say it's like an AIL team taking on a provincial team, Donegal, but it's like they are big gaps. You know, they're in terms of size, in terms of pick, in terms of power, in terms of athleticism. It's a big gap.
And it always comes down to the talent pool, doesn't it? Yeah. Just more resources, more players to pick.
Yeah. And the more you have to pick, things like size and athleticism and ability, you're kind of taking away those imponderables, shall we call them. That the bigger your pool, you know, if I have a population and I'm picking of 250,000, I'll find a few lads the size of the O'Callaghan around the place. I just will. Yeah. That's the way it is. And whereas our pool in Roscommon was, I think, 65,000, and there's a big claim in Balhadrin for a good few thousand of them as well on the border. So, you know, the pick is, and then you go to Leitrim or Longford where the pick is 35,000 or something like that. You know, and obviously the women and children aren't available for selection. So then the numbers get quite low.
You said in the book about the conditioning that a lot of the guys you felt, or some of the guys you felt, didn't have the conditioning that was required. Was that because they came to it too late, Kevin?
That's a hard one to nail down. They certainly, I would say, at the beginning of, shall we say, the high performance, the idea of a high performance athlete playing Gaelic football, that idea must be 10, 12, 15 years old, I imagine. Rugby got to it, obviously, before that, but the Gaels never too far behind the curve. So I would say Roscommon probably did come to that late. So John Evans would have been the first one to really ratchet it up. And he got a gym built, very fine gym built locally, you know, in the county board offices, and that worked really well. And so that was the first kind of serious introduction from it. They're introduced at academy level now, so, you know, it's an accepted norm now. But back in those days, it wasn't. And then we tried to see it through and bring it to another level. But that culture, I certainly, as manager, found difficult to sell the culture and to insist on the culture, you know. Now, a lot of the guys were fabulous at it, you know, and they bought into it. This, you know, this was their lifestyle, from Sigerson, from DCU, from UCD, UCG, etc., etc. Well, then there was others that didn't quite. And again, I think you'll both understand this. A lot of the time, it's the most talented fellas that don't quite buy into that culture, because I often think, you know, it's looked upon as, that old gym stuff, that's for the average players who just want to get picked, you know, to make themselves available for selection. Like, the real talent only needs bits of that. And you cannot compete. This is the one thing I've learned in my 3 years, and it's getting the same across all the sport, rugby, soccer. You know, if you're not able to challenge athletically, aerobically, in terms of strength, in terms of size, like, you cannot coach size, you cannot coach speed. You can coach a little bit of speed, you can improve it a wee bit, but if you don't have these basics, you cannot compete. You'll compete for maybe 45, 50 minutes, and the last 20 minutes then is overlap city, and that's what happens.
Is one of the biggest challenges for us common opportunity, even just bringing it right back to employment? And, you know, I notice around Cork and Limerick, amateur players, you know, if they're playing in the AIL, they have to go to Dublin for work.
Well, and that's a, remember now, you're talking about big cities there, so it's absolutely a valid point. I think it might be in the book, Bree, I'm not sure, but certainly it's a number I remember well. At one stage, I had 26 of my panel, and I think the panel was maybe 34 at the time, or maybe 36. 26 of them were based outside of Roscommon. So Dublin, Limerick, Galway, some of them were guards down in Tip, down in Johnstown, the like of that. Some of them were in, there was a lad in college in Cavan, you know, they were spread all over the country. 26, like, on the road three times a week coming to training, like, because, and then when they qualify out of college, there's none of those guys coming back, in general, coming back to Roscommon to work in the greater Roscommon area. And that's just the reality. That's not just Roscommon's reality, of course. I think one of the big arguments Mayo would have put up over the years is half their team is, you know, based outside the county, and it's an inch or a percentage not having them all together, you know, training halfway up the country or having some of the sessions in Dublin. It's difficulty.
I hate throwing out a problem like that without a solution, though, but there's no solution, should it not? It's just economics. It's just the way it is.
Well, we're very Dublin-centric now in terms of our economy, and that's as you said, that's a reality.
So I know that counties are trying to catch up. We just mentioned the conditioning and the athleticism that the very top counties have. And Roscommon have recently appointed a performance manager, and Cork have recently done it with Aidan O'Connell. David Mannix is the Roscommon one. Is it too late? Are the counties too far behind, or can that gap be closed just on the conditioning and physical stakes?
Yeah, it definitely can be closed. No question about that. Because these are controllables. Okay, the absolute, you know, gifted players like a Clifford, these guys we're talking about, you know, Paul Mannion, these sort of guys, okay, that's, you can't control that. They just, you have them or you don't have them. But in terms of the prep, in terms of having these top guys running the programs for you at home, yes, absolutely. If you have the resources to employ them, and you know, you have access to the gym and you've access to your centre of excellence, and you know, unfortunately Roscommon are a bit behind the curve just on the basic resources of training fee. We don't have a centre of excellence just at the minute, but it's in the pipeline, and we get there eventually. And remember, you know, any squad, you look at Leicester City, I know I'm dipping into the professional arena now, but you know, you get a squad of 22-23 fellas together who are well prepared or well set up, and they have reasonable talent, they can be hugely competitive. Of course they can.
I remember reading a really interesting thing Arsene Wenger said about the point of difference no longer being physical. It's no longer fitness or speed, it's mental. So it's pushed on to that level. But I think probably in football and hurling at the moment, some counties have made that stride where others are nearly being left behind.
Well, certainly playing catch up.
Just another element as well, and we were just talking about the pressure and the commitment. I think a lot of people were taken aback by the level of your involvement in the whole setup, the fact that you had to take out your credit card to pay for team meals, that you were getting gym memberships for players, and especially because Roscommon would be viewed as one of the counties who were on, I suppose, the more elite side of things.
Well, I think I was making the point to you, you know, that there's an elite within the elite, you know, there's the kind of the Corks, Dublins, Kerrys who have access, you know, to major resources, as Mayo have as well, and even though you're in the top eight, you know, you can be on the hind tit to a certain extent in terms of resources. But obviously, you know, I should emphasise, I was paid back for that, Marie, and that kind of became, I won't say a headline out of it, but it's the point I was trying to make was that these are issues that other counties, they just don't arise. But when you're in a situation like Roscommon, when your manager, it's nearly a family. It's like family. You'll do whatever has to be done. You want your group to feel loved, not to feel second class in any way. And so whatever has to be done, you know, we happened to be at that time just going through really bad cash flow in terms of the board, and the finances were in bad shape. And I had a sense that it could come to this someday, but it just happened to be up in Tyrone or at a training camp on another day. But there was no big issue. I was just making the point, you know, as I think I also made the point in the book, making having a laugh towards Jim Gavin. I doubt Jim had to do that type of thing. You know, we used to have to close all gates in the training ground at about 10 to 12, myself and Fergal O'Donnell, on dark, damp nights. And our kind of sign-off laugh used to be, do you think is Jim doing this above in Parnell Park? Probably not.
We used to slag in the pro game anyway, but Munster, we used to always say, when this team goes pro, lads, there'll be no stopping us. When we have to do stuff like scrub out the ice baths and stuff like that. But I think it leads to a good culture as well.
It does.
One thing I'm massively interested in, Kevin, in your book, The Pressure Game, you mentioned online haters. Mm. And it's a real interesting point to me. I met my old principal of my school, and he said, when bullying took place when you were in school, Donica, it went from 9 o'clock to 3:30 and you got a break. Mm, but this is 24/7 now for these young people. Yeah. Maybe just your own experience. Yeah. And
Not a good experience, Donica, because it takes a fairly strong person to completely shut it out, because I have young children. Well, they're in their 20s now, but, you know, and they're hugely protective of their dad and all that sort of stuff. And, you know, my eldest girl, I once or twice answered one of these, and I said, "No, don't. Yeah. Whatever you do, don't answer them." You know, but it's what I'm amazed is the psychology of it. Are these people, how they have no sense of context? They must feel they're in some vacuum where they can just say whatever. There was one. It was so unfair to players, to management, to me, because they obviously had no real information or insight into what was the reality of our city. But that would never stop them second guessing or making, adding 2 and 2 and getting 5. But I don't know where it's all going to end. But it is fairly vicious. A lot of it is untrue, obviously. But I just don't know where it goes in terms of the Gardaí or that sort of stuff. But it's a few times it just really was on the edge, really, really nasty stuff. And it's just not nice. It is not nice.
How would you protect your group now? If you know, in hindsight, you know, guys on teams,
it's so difficult. I mean, what do you say? Give me lads phones. Like the minute we meet up, phones into a bag. You know, now we tried to keep some discipline around the phone. But the bit for me, like I'm in my late 50s, I don't fully understand the generation that have the phones, that everything they do. Like I'm still looking at maps. You know, I've just come from driving to Belfast. I take out a map before I go.
Kevin, are you?
No, I'm not. or if I'm booking a restaurant, I'll ring them. You know, but my kids, like we were in London last year, the year before, and kind of came up and was right. We've that booked and that booked and that, and we're going here and we're booked in to see that monument tomorrow or whatever. And I said, well, who are you talking to? Everything is done on the phone, and I know, obviously I'm not a caveman. I know the power of these things and I use them from time, but I'm not fully immersed in them. Yeah. Whereas the generation that I was looking after are. I mean, they go to their phone just about every time they have a spare moment.
I moved to Worcester and I noticed that straight away. Everyone was on their phone. So I came from a culture where we chatted and messed an awful lot around the team room. I asked, could we put away the phones? And they were actually saying, we're having all the fun is on the phone.
Yeah,
so they included me on the WhatsApp group, on the Snapchat, and it was brilliant fun. Yeah. It was just a different way of putting it across. But I think there's things that you could take that we used to have a 24-hour ban either side of a game, just so that someone wouldn't react.
Yeah.
You know, because people can be quite nasty, but it was just a rule, and we always had a rule into a box at mealtime that we chatted.
But you know the fella that always wants to be first with the news to tell you what someone said about you?
Oh, yeah.
You don't have to search too far before you bump into him.
Yeah.
Kevin, that kind of highlights as well the importance of management when you're in the role of manager. And I think just from reading recently Ronan McNamee's story, the Tyrone footballer, how important it is and how much responsibility now is on managers as well, just to kind of keep an eye on players, you know, off the field holistically almost. Did you find that as well as a manager?
It's a huge responsibility, Marie, and you have to remember now, I say 34 players in a panel, 15 plus in a backroom team. So you're the manager of quite a decent sized small business, if you like. You know, you're 50 people and you're trying to give them some face time, so, you know, time on the phone, meeting time, etc. And it's not simple, and you're trying to have their world as perfect as you can, so that you get at least performance at the weekend. So you want everything to be right. You want their work situation, their college situation. And I have to say, you know, even though we were a mid-ranked county, Roscommon did an awful lot in terms of that. You know, even to the extent we had taxis bringing them rather than a bus situation. They collected them at DCU or at their digs or at their house, wherever they were. And, you know, we made sure we got them back there. We didn't drop them at an RV point and let them make their way home in the middle of the night or anything like that. We looked after them as best we could. You know, we had good people around the management team if they needed to talk to people. That was available all the time. And all in the context, Donnacha, I'm sure you recognize this, and I won't say take it for granted, but you went into a professional area, mm-hmm. all in the context of it being an amateur game, even though the background is as professional as you can possibly make it. But it is difficult, Marie. Like there's no getting away that trying to be in control and make sure there's no bumps in the road for 34 footballers and 15 backroom team is a major challenge. For the manager and perhaps his assistant and the coach.
So when you take all that into account, like you're talking about the pressures that come with management, the time that it takes, the professional people that you have to surround yourself, you've likened it to running a small business. Do you think it's sustainable that in the future the role of the manager of an intercounty team can stay as an amateur person?
That's a really good question, because the only way I see it going is ramping up further. And, you know, just look at the Jim Gavin situation where, you know, it looks like work and sport just collided and there's only so many hours in the day and something has to give. And certainly the managers, you know, that I know that are really in the game for, say, Division 1 and 2, I'd say managers every level. I don't want to keep it to the first two divisions. Like are putting in, have to be putting in 10, 12 hours a day. Just have to be. If you just even think of the phone time or the planning time, and then if it's a training night, there's 5 or 6 hours eaten up just straight away there, going to it, arranging it, training, the aftermath. You know, you have to bite to eat, you have to have a chat with your management, how that go tonight, where are we tomorrow, what's the plan for
throw
the week.
Throw in match analysis.
Yeah, all that, yeah. So there's hours upon hours. So your question's a good question, and I suppose I'm old school. It's not something I'm mad about, you know. And then there's a push from, or there appears to be a push among certain players, maybe there are certain elements in the GAA that maybe the top part of the playing cadre will professionalise. It's out there, you know. Even though the GPA deny it and GAA say absolutely no, like that push is there, because what's the next step? Mm-hmm. The next step is, it goes further on, or else we downgrade it and say, no, you can only come together now X amount of weeks a year. It's a club, number one type of organisation. And, you know, they have these rules where, you know, there's training periods in the year where you just cannot come together. Now, if that was enforced, it'd be, you know, by rule, it'd be very easy for the county game to be squeezed. And, you know, it becomes like the international part of it, the soccer club, if you like, where you're with the club, but they release you to play international football. Well, they release you to play with your county. But if that were to happen, the standard would drop dramatically, obviously, because you don't have the same time together. If you're just, you know, if GAA becomes a county game, which, you know, a lot of members feel it should be, but, you know, I wouldn't want to see that happen either personally. But what's the next move? I don't know, Maria. It's impossible to say.
I had a real interesting one last week. I met Tim O'Neill, who was involved with the first sponsorship of Munster with Bank of Ireland, and he told me,
oh yeah, not Tim, yeah, yeah.
He couldn't believe when Declan Kidney came in to chat about sponsoring the team, and I was there. Declan Kidney, are you joking? Like the team,
they sent in
coach.
The manager, the coach,
And it just shows how far rugby has come. Yeah, there would be absolutely no way that
the commercial guy or the CEO
absolutely
is in
that
of
way.
That, yeah.
But just on that, then, like with all those juggling balls of being not only the Bonner Store but everything in that, there is pressure, and that falls down on your family and friends. And did you find that a bit, that they're the ones that probably get the brunt of?
Yeah, Well, they're the ones that see you coming in the evenings in bad form. If, you know, training hasn't been great or the result has gone against you, you certainly don't have the time. Like, the weekends are just gone. Yeah. So the idea of meeting up with lads at the weekend and your own mates, that's out of the question. And you know, there is a sense of responsibility. I've said this a few times. You're the face of the county team. The people you meet up on the up the street or around the towns, you know, they're just looking forward to Croke Park and the summer and qualifying and having a great time. And the expectation is, you know, you'll sort this out, or this will all work, won't it? It'll be grand. And yet, like, it is, when it's working, Donegal, it's unreal. I mean, when you're buzzing and winning, as we all know as sports people, it's the greatest thing of all time. But when it goes the other way and results are going against you and the pressure is mounting, it's a tough bloody place. And you know, the only people you have ultimately, the people that see you live this, and you have to live it. You have to have an outrageous passion and commitment to it. It's not part time. Are your family? They're the people that see you very raw and very annoyed with county board officials, or very annoyed with players on your group, or very annoyed with some member of management. They see you letting fly at 11:30 at home, maybe over a cup of tea in the evening, and they have a real sense of that pressure. But my family were just magnificent throughout the 3 years, and very, very supportive, very protective, and the conversation we're having, unfortunately, I'm touching towards a lot of the negative sides of it. Like, I'd hate you to think that I didn't have a blast. I mean, we won, we lost, we lived. I say that to so many of my players when I meet them now, you know, now that I'm out of it. Like, we had great fun. When we won a Connacht Championship against the Head by hammering the favourites in the final, jeez, like, we felt invincible. You know, we went up and took on Mayo, and we were within 30 seconds of knocking them out of the Championship. I remember saying, where could this end, lads? You know, that's mad. But, you know, and winning our Division 2 and getting back to Division 1, qualifying for the Super 8s, they were all great moments for us as a group, because we were coming from a very low base, you know. And to see incrementally, week on week, the whole momentum of the group, of the county, of the media that were taking a big interest in our story, to see all that come was great. But unfortunately, when you flip the coin, you know, the highs are high, but the lows are so bloody low. You know?
Would you go back?
No.
If Mayo came calling?
No, Marie, no. I made they won't come calling anyway. But I thought that through very carefully. You know, I'd given it my best shot. You know, I was all right at it. I wasn't top, but I was okay at it. I had a great club run, and I had great fun with the county. And, you know, I tried to get the Mayo job twice. I wasn't successful. And I'm forever grateful that Roscommon gave me the chance to challenge myself in that environment. And, you know, by and large, I was all right at it. I was okay. The team I had, by and large, we weren't too bad at all. We had a lot of fun. You know, we won and we lost, and we had great crack in around it. I think we did it the right way. You know, maybe a little bit naive. That someone else can judge that. I don't care, really. We had a lot of fun doing it the way we wanted to do it. For Roscommon to go to the next level, of course, they have to change personnel and set up and all that. And Anthony has done a great job on that, and I commend him. I have no issues in my departure with it. None at all. I had great fun, but had to jump back into it. Not a chance.
It was the quickest no of all time.
It was just no. I had my time. Like, I'm 30 kind of years tooling around at club management and inter-county. I did minors, you know. I did I did Roscommon minors, I did Mayo under 21s. I coached and trained Mayo for a year back in the 90s, at senior level, and then I took on the Roscommon thing, having done the bridges. So I've been well immersed in it. And all that time, I might point out, I was with RTE and I was trying to keep an army job going.
Raise a family.
And again, by and large, it all kind of fairly reasonably worked out. Not perfect, but fairly all right.
Yeah. We're chatting to Kevin McStay about his book, The Pressure Game. Kevin, I'm interested, you mentioned that there, jumping the fence from being the coach to the pundit, and you know how it feels to get the maybe honest appraisal sometimes, other times harsh and over the top. How do you feel now dishing it out?
Well, the first thing I'd say is I got a fair, you know, and I'd have a fairly acute ear to what was happening over the 3 years. Roscommon, my team, myself, I think I got a fair shot of 99% of the media. And that's not a bad number now, is it, in fairness? For some of the results we got.
Shame the 1%. Yeah.
No, it wasn't me, okay?
I leave him out. Wasn't jury. Yeah. So, but again, I would have expected to get a fair rattle at it. You know, I mean, I when I was back there in RT or writing for different papers for the Herald or for the Times, I genuinely don't think I went about it as fair as I could. Now, maybe I got it wrong and I hurt people's feelings with some of the lines I wrote or said or whatever. If I did, I certainly didn't set out to do it. But the I got a very fair whip at it. And now that I'm back in with the Sunday Game and delighted to be back in, I know so much more now than I did previously, obviously. You know, the game moved on so much in that period.
And that's the question I have here. That's going to happen again now really soon.
Well, is it? I don't know how much more we have. Maybe it's always evolving, is it?
I feel it does. I remember chatting to Dennis Leamy and he'd left rugby only 3 months ago and we were attacking rucks differently and he was there. That makes complete sense. Mm. And that's probably the question for maybe punditry and people involved in it. How do they keep evolving with the game that's moving at?
Well, the punditry was well behind the game, in my view. It really was. And I think even, you know, I watch all the pundits across all the sport because I'm interested. And the punditry in rugby was well behind as well. Mm-hmm. But they have definitely upped their game. There's no question about that in terms of their analysis, their use of stats, you know, and the big challenge now is to get that balance right. Yeah. You know, it can't be a stat-laden analysis. Like the human eye... And this, you know, is this science or art? You know, you have to have a feel for it. You know, the big eye or your own eye doesn't lie. The eye test is still a big part of it, but the stats are as well. But I think I would say this now because I'm part of it. But I think the Sunday Game have really upped their game. But trying to get the balance right now between stats and analysis and entertainment, that is a challenge for sure. But I learned so much in the 3 years that I was involved in Intercounty that I feel I'm a more rounded pundit now. When I look back maybe to the early years, you'd probably be a bit embarrassed maybe about some of the, you know, the idea that there's a man on the sideline, whether he's Jim Gavin or Peter Kane or Mickey Hart, the idea that he's in complete control or Joe Smith or whatever, and it's a game of chess and they're just moving things, that is... so nonsensical, but it's what we pundits like to believe. Well, you know, if you know the one on the TV where the piece of technology allows the player to move, you can move him in and out. I mean, I find that just hilarious. Yeah. You know, if he was 10 yards up, further up the line, this is where he should have been. Come on. And so I really enjoyed it. I did my first All-Ireland commentary, which was a big bucket wish moment for me, and I enjoyed the year back, and I certainly would have a sense now of being much fairer to the manager and the players, because I understand the madness of it. Like there is a certain madness on that sideline when the game gets tight and every ball is being contested ferociously, and it's just a bounce now. Just a few breaks, a few bounces here and there are going to make you a brilliant manager and the poor other fella a plonker. And that's an unfortunate place we are with a lot of our analysis is, you know, the team that loses by a point are useless and the manager is a clown and the fellow that wins by a point is a genius, which of course, you know, it's not true.
Kevin, just finally before we finish up, I don't know if you agree with me, but it does feel like we're in a funny time for the GAA. We have new rule changes coming in. The Mark, which has got an awful lot of, has fueled an awful lot of debate. We have the second tier championship coming in. We have negotiations ongoing between the GAA and the GPA. We have training reaching levels that we have never seen before. Where do you think in 5 years' time the GAA is going to be? And then you throw in the CPA as well and all that's going on with them.
Well, 2020 is... it's pivotal in my view, and you've listed them all now, and I'll just delve into one or two of them because I wouldn't have enough time to. But the rule changes, they were voted through hastily. I think they were not well thought through by the delegates. I'm sure they were well thought through by the people who presented them, and that all the empirical evidence that one would need. But I'll take my own county of Mayo. We didn't even send a delegate, you know, to a really important moment in the game where a tier two competition has been voted on and new rules are being voted on, and they saw fit to go to the county final rather than send delegates. And other counties probably did that. And then when tier two was voted on, I think I made this point to you previously, Marie, of the 12 teams that we absolutely, well, have a good sense will be in tier two. I think I counted that day, I was trying to figure out who had voted for what. I think about 9 of them voted against it. So here we are now getting ready for a tier two to happen. Dates are out now. So, you know, the lights are on, the wheels are down, the plane is going to land now. And we have over 50% of the contestants, their delegates voted against the concept. And then you put in, you mentioned the mark, and there's other ones. What I would say, you know, who's going to measure the distance now between the pass? What is it? Is it 20 metres? I think it is, isn't it? Yeah, it is. You can imagine now when that's not Ireland final and there's only 19 metres between the pass, mm-hmm. and you get a handy tap over to win the All-Ireland by a point. There'll be somebody murdered. I mean,
Hawkeye.
Hawkeye won't even figure it. So that was not well thought through in my view, but I'll at least do it the courtesy of I'll wait and see, but I'll be amazed if they turn out the way they're envisaged. The GPA haven't signed off on their latest deal, and that is, there's going to take a fair few cracking of heads before that happens, because the gap between them now and what we loosely call official GA and grassroots GA, it's getting wider. And I don't blame the GPA for that. I think it's the perception issue, or they're just not selling what they're trying to do perhaps as well as they should be, because I do think they're well intentioned. I really do. Even though I was a slow starter to support them 10 years ago, perhaps. But I think they are well-intentioned in terms of the modern player. And I saw firsthand when I was with Roscommon all the good stuff they were able to do. But those issues are out there. And we're going to have a change of presidency fairly soon. Again, I think John is in his last 12 months now. So he has some major, major issues to try and tidy up. And then he has, of the things that have been passed now, you know, to see those to their full term is not going to be simple. And the Super 8s are going to come up for discussion as well. This is year 3 now, is that right? It is, yeah. This is year 3 coming in. And, you know, something that should have been done yonks ago, like taking Dublin out of Croke Park for 2 matches, to, you know, send them down the country. You know, a monkey in charge of a jackhammer would have figured that out the day the fixtures were made, but it takes us 2 years to figure it out. At least it's the right thing. But there's a lot of challenges. 2020 is going to be a big, big, big year.
Kevin, thank you very much for joining us. The Pressure Game is available in all good bookstores, and we wish you the best of luck with it. And for GAA fans and all sports fans, it's a fascinating read. That was Kevin Maxtay there speaking to us about a whole load of things, including his managerial career, his hopes for the future, and punditry. The scores so far tonight: Man City have beaten Dynamo Zagreb 4-1, and Atalanta have beaten Shakhtar Donetsk 3-0.
Yeah, tomorrow we have our Thursday panel, and we're going to be chatting to three of Ireland's top refs, so Michelle O'Neill, David Goff and Johnny Lacey. So I'm really looking forward to that. You can get your questions into us on 51552. Marie, you're excited about it?
I'm excited about it, but I'm really excited to know whether refs liked you or not.
I don't know.
We can ask Johnny Lacey.
Ask Johnny. He never really reffed us, though.
But he'd know. He was more of a teammate. There's a referees club, and they know who they like refs and who they don't like.
Yeah. Do you know what? I actually got an awful lot of help from Dave McHugh just to how to be better. And one thing he said to me was, when referees come into the changing rooms, you look like a dog with rabies. Like, you just look...
You look like trouble.
You look crazy. Yeah. Do you know what else is crazy? Tara Stewart is up next.
Game on 2FM. Weekdays from 6.